Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today, well, it's ambitious. We're aiming to give you a clear framework for something incredibly complex, the structure of a spiritual life.
Yeah, it's a big topic. We've gathered some really insightful sources looking at how we develop values, how we find meaning, and the very nature of belief itself.
So where do we start?
Well, the material kicks off with a core idea. A spiritual life needs spiritual goals. Simple enough, right? But those goals, they're completely shaped by the values you hold.
And values aren't just abstract ideas, are they?
Not at all. They're the active tools, you know, the yardsticks you use constantly. They set your priorities. They frame how you judge almost everything around you, often without even realizing it.
Okay, let's dig into that with something maybe a bit surprising, something the sources really challenge us on.
Go for it.
Think about this. Scientific facts, complex math even, say a detailed historical account. None of these things in themselves have any inherent value.
Like a volcano erupting or an equation.
Exactly. Or a treaty getting signed. They just are. They don't possess meaning or value until we as humans actually give it to them.
And that's the fascinating part, isn't it? The human capacity, the sources are clear. Value isn't physical. It's subjective. It's based on experience. And they use this term supermaterial.
Supermaterial. Explain that a bit.
Okay. Think about a $20 bill. Physically, it's just cotton and linen, right? Its actual worth isn't in the material. It's entirely in our collective agreement, our shared belief in its value. That belief, that agreement, that's super material. It exists in our minds, our consciousness, not the paper itself.
So this ability to assign meaning, to give value, it's uniquely human.
That's what the sources argue, this capacity, you know, recognizing symbols, using complex language, understanding math, even thinking about what meaning means.
The meaning of meanings.
Yes. That's pointed to as evidence of self-consciousness, reflective thought, and, well, spiritual roots.
Yeah.
It suggests a level of awareness that's just fundamentally different from the animal kingdom.
And these values we hold, they aren't static, are they? They change.
Absolutely. We're dynamic beings. The universe is dynamic. Sure. Think about what you cared about as a kid. A favorite toy, maybe, that probably doesn't hold the same value now.
Definitely not.
Or, you know, your priorities before starting a family versus after, or after a major career shift or a loss. Our values are constantly shifting based on our lived experiences.
Okay, so if values shape meaning, let's break down meaning itself. The sources talk about different layers.
Right. Most of our day-to-day operates on the more surface levels. First, there's just dictionary meaning.
Like the common understanding of a word. Faith or justice.
Exactly. Just the sheer definition. Then there's contextual meaning.
Okay. Like how we use the same word differently.
Perfect example is love. You might say, oh, I love this ice cream. And also, I love my child.
Yes. Same word. Totally different reality.
Totally different. The context, the depth, the commitment. It defines the actual meaning of the experience in that moment.
But then there's the big one. The ultimate question. What is the meaning of life? That's asking for something else entirely, isn't it?
It really is. That's asking for a cosmological answer. The purpose of existence itself, does it all have some grand objective, some ultimate value beyond just us?
And when you ask that question philosophically, the sources say there are basically two paths you can go down.
Two main avenues, yeah. The first is the materialist view. Essentially, life is a cosmic accident. It's random. And we can never really know if it has any ultimate meaning.
And that path lead somewhere specific.
Often, yes.
Yeah.
It tends to lead towards two particular philosophies. First, cynicism.
Which is?
The belief that deep down, all human actions are just driven by self-interest, pure selfishness.
Okay, and the second?
Nihilism.
Yeah.
Which is the idea that existence itself is senseless, it's chaotic. And because of that, all values are just relative. Nothing truly matters.
That sounds bleak.
It often is. And there's a practical problem. These outlooks frequently correlate with higher rates of depression and anxiety. It seems the human spirit kind of struggles with perceived meaninglessness.
And philosophically?
Well, nihilism kind of eats itself, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If nothing has objective meaning or value, then the philosophy of nihilism itself can't be objectively true either. It undermines its own foundation.
That makes me think of that C.S. Lewis quote, something like, if the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning.
Exactly. The very fact we can ask the question that we can conceive of meaninglessness suggests that meaning itself is a possibility, maybe even the default state we search for.
So what's the alternative path, the second avenue?
That's the positive perspective, the belief that life is purposeful, that it's revealed perhaps by a universal personal, intentional source, you could say a supreme being.
And this outlook leads somewhere different.
Definitely. This kind of faith, this optimism, it connects you to something bigger. It tends to foster inner peace, self-esteem, confidence, a sense of belonging in the cosmos.
So really, believing life is meaningful is a kind of choice, a way to actively fill your life with spiritual purpose.
It's presented that way, yes.
Yeah.
A choice to seek out and align with meaning, often felt through inner guidance, that sense of spirit contact.
And the goal becomes...
Well, Leo Tolstoy put it very powerfully, didn't he? He said something like, grow spiritually and help others to do so. That is the meaning of life. Simple, but profound.
But, okay, if we go back to that idea of relative values, if everything is relative, isn't there a danger, like anything goes?
Huge danger. That's extreme relativism, and it quickly leads to devaluing everything, especially human life and effort. It can become a moral vacuum.
The sources use a kind of dark, humorous example to show the extreme end of that, right? The Ferengi.
Ah, yes. The Ferengi rules of acquisition, a fictional value system totally dominated by material gain and self-interest.
Things like never place friendship above profit.
Or a man is only worth the sum of his possessions. It's presented as this caricature of pure selfishness, and the point is, such a system is spiritually unreal. It's unreasonable. It can't last because it consumes itself.
So while we have to accept that many things are relative in our physical world, facts, history, objects, the spiritual path requires something more stable.
Exactly. It requires acknowledging the reality of absolute values. These are seen as divine, unchanging qualities inherent in the nature of, well, God or the Supreme Being.
And these form the foundation.
They form the bedrock, the four divine pillars, truth, beauty, goodness, and love. These are the ultimate standards, the yardsticks for all genuine spiritual thought and action.
Now, before we get into what each of those means, there's an important distinction the sources make.
Yes, crucial. There's that which is value, which is spiritual, divine, absolute, like love itself.
And then
there's that which has value. These are things, situations, relationships that embody those divine qualities.
Give me an example.
Okay, think of family life. The family itself isn't inherently good or valuable. A family has value only to the extent that it reflects and practices the absolute values, love, goodness, truth, maybe even beauty in its interactions. Its value is qualified by the divine values it manages to express.
Got it. So the value isn't in the structure, but in the spirit animating it.
Precisely.
Okay, let's look at those pillars then, starting with truth. What does absolute truth mean here? It's not just facts, right?
Definitely not just facts. Facts are important, but they can be isolated, static bits of knowledge. Truth, in this spiritual sense, is dynamic. It's about seeing the connections, the relationships between the facts.
Grasping the bigger picture.
Exactly. Understanding the context, the whole, seeing how things fit together in the, well, the cosmic sense. Truth is alive.
But is all truth absolute?
The sources suggest that while most of our knowledge in this time-space universe is relative, there are some absolute truths we can grasp, like the fundamental truth, I exist. But mostly, it's about seeking the relationships, the dynamic understanding, while staying humble about how much is still relative from our limited viewpoint.
Okay, next pillar. Goodness. This is more than just being nice, I take it.
Oh, much more. Being nice can be passive, even superficial sometimes. True goodness, as described here, is an active, principled policy. It means consistently choosing to return goodness, even when you face evil, injustice, or betrayal.
That sounds incredibly difficult.
It is. It requires immense inner strength, real spiritual commitment. But it's presented as maybe the most reliable sign of genuine spiritual progress, maintaining goodness under any and all circumstances.
Right. Third pillar, beauty. This isn't just about pretty things, is it?
No, it goes much deeper than the material world. Yes, there's beauty in nature, in art, but spiritual beauty also includes the beauty of noble thoughts, the beauty of courageous actions, the inherent beauty of a well-lived spiritual life.
So it manifests as things like harmony, rhythm.
Yes, harmony, rhythm, symmetry. But also, ultimately, wisdom. Spiritual achievements themselves are seen as possessing a divine beauty.
And the final pillar, love. This seems like the big one.
It absolutely is. Love is positioned as the ultimate spiritual force. It actually dominates and unifies the other three, truth, beauty, and goodness. It's their living expression, all rolled into one.
How is this kind of love defined? It's not just sentimentality.
Far from it. It's defined as compassionate, yes, but also parental, assertive, practical, and profoundly wise. is not passive acceptance. It's a dynamic, active, world-changing force.
Understanding these absolute values, it really changes how you might view organized religion, doesn't it? I'm thinking of Gandhi's line, God has no religion.
That fits perfectly. Religion, any religion, formal or informal, is essentially a human attempt. It's us trying to grasp, understand, and maybe institutionalize a spiritual reality that we only perceive dimly.
The sources use an analogy with science, right?
Yeah, I like that one. Think of physics or astronomy. If scientists discover a better, more accurate understanding of the universe, they don't just throw out all of physics.
No, they refine it. They update the models.
Exactly. They fix the framework, build on the new truth. Similarly, the argument goes, God, or the ultimate reality, can't be perfectly captured or defined by any single human formula, dogma, or institution. And we shouldn't judge the source by the flaws or mistakes of the human attempts to understand it.
So this leads to different styles of spiritual practice.
Right. The sources differentiate between two broad approaches. First, there's what's called the religion of the mind.
What does that look like?
That tends to be about upholding a fixed, authoritative belief system. It often demands conformity to specific doctrines, rituals, interpretations. Sometimes there's less emphasis on critical thinking or personal experience.
And the alternative?
The religion of the spirit. This approach is always open to new truth, wherever it comes from. It's focused on personal spiritual insight, intuition, and it champions freedom of thought and expression.
So it's less about the doing and more about the being.
Precisely. It's less about performing the correct ritual or saying the exact right prayer, and much more about being a morally good, honorable, ethical, faithful person in your everyday life. Your character becomes the true worship.
And someone following this religion of the spirit, they aren't confined to one box.
Not at all. They feel free to draw wisdom and inspiration from all world religions, from philosophy, from personal experience, without needing to rigidly adhere to the specific authority or dogma of any single one. They follow their inner spiritual compass.
Which implies that true religion has to be deeply personal.
Absolutely fundamental. True religion, the sources insist, doesn't live in the grand building or the institution. It lives in the individual heart, the individual mind.
So if you accept that, wow. That means there are potentially 8 billion unique, valid spiritual paths unfolding right now on Earth.
That's the implication. 8 billion unique experiences, all potentially moving toward the same ultimate destination. Spiritual growth, maybe even perfection of spirit.
But how can you be sure your personal path is valid if it's so subjective?
Ah, well, that's the key. The ultimate validation for you is your own subjective experience. Objective, scientific proof of God, or spiritual reality in a lab. That's probably impossible in our material world.
But your own experience.
Your own direct personal experience of something greater, with inner guidance, of spiritual presence that cannot be honestly denied or discredited by anyone else. It's your reality.
It becomes the highest form of evidence for the person having the experience.
Exactly, as the sources put it. Those who know God have experienced the fact of his presence. No amount of intellectual argument can take that lived experience away from you.
But this doesn't mean we should all just retreat into our own private bubbles, right? There's still a place for community.
Definitely. And that's where the idea of socialized religion comes in.
Yeah.
But it's defined very broadly here.
How so?
It's seen as a simple, unifying philosophy. One that acknowledges the common spiritual goals we all share. The pursuit of truth, love, goodness, beauty, for the benefit of everyone. For human fellowship.
So its aim should be huge. To unite humanity.
Yes, to inspire all of humanity by focusing relentlessly on what we have in common spiritually, not on the dogmatic differences that divide us. It needs to be forward-looking, not stuck in the past.
And what's its main job, its most important function?
According to these sources, the most vital task of any positive socialized religion is simply to promote individual spiritual growth, to encourage people to embrace and live by those divine values, truth, beauty, goodness, love.
And that has real-world consequences.
Absolutely. This is the so what for society. When up individuals genuinely start to prioritize these higher ideals, when people work on self-control, cultivate wisdom, strengthen family life based on love and respect, commit to ethical behavior.
Then the larger systems start to change. Politics, economics.
Exactly. Society inevitably reflects the moral caliber of its people. If individuals raise their standards, the institutions they create and participate in will eventually reflect that improvement.
It really brings home that advice from Mother Teresa, doesn't it? When asked about promoting world peace.
Go home and love your family. Yes. It starts right there, with the values we practice in our closest relationships in our daily lives.
So we've covered a lot of ground, from our basic human ability to give meaning to things, even a simple dollar bill.
All the way to the necessity of adopting these four absolute divine values, truth, beauty, goodness, and love, as the sort of the core operating system for our lives.
And putting this into practice, defining your life by these absolutes, it seems to demand a serious look at our loyalties.
It really does. Ambition is good, right? It motivates us. We need it. But if ambition morphs into self-importance, or if the love of wealth becomes the top priority,
that gets in the way of spiritual progress.
Profoundly detrimental, the sources say. Spiritual growth seems to require that our ultimate loyalty is to these spiritual values above everything else. Material success, social standing, they have to be secondary.
Loyalty can't really be divided if you want to move upward spiritually.
That seems to be the message. So maybe the final thought for everyone listening is this. Think about your highest ideals. What truly inspires you at the deepest level?
Okay.
And then ask yourself honestly, do your current loyalties, your loyalty to your job perhaps, to making money, to your social image, to any material thing, do those loyalties truly allow you to reach as high spiritually as those ideals demand? It's a challenging question.